Bob Hoy, I know you watch these markets like very few of our top guests.
A theme I was thinking of using in this week's piece was that major financial contractions are so methodical. This one set itself up. What really got me going, Chris, was the peak in December, January. We had that because in October the 4th, a year ago, it was the whole world was going to get bubbled, including the Dow Jones Industrials, and that they would likely peak in the May, in the December-January window when so many terrific speculations have done so. So you take a look then at the NASDAQ comp, and as it was completing its rally in January, the weekly RSI, which is momentum, it got up to 89, which is high. So I looked back on the great dot-com bubble that concluded in early 2000, and the NASDAQ comp, it got up to an RSI of 84, not as strong as the New York Stock Exchange comp. So that was a major event. So then we looked for rallies in industrial commodities. We looked for favorable action in the yield curve and in credit spreads out to around June. So we were looking for, we'll call it sunshine, out to around the middle of the year. And yeah, the industrial commodities rallied nicely. Lumber itself had a bubble, incredible bubble all on its own. And then these things have gone down.
Well, you know, a big component of the lumber bubble, tariffs on Canada, because it imposed a tax burden on lumber producers on that industry. And you know, it actually bumped up the mean building cost on a new home in the United States substantially.
Oh yeah, but it's given up. Like it's, the high was 659 and down it's like 3.
They were front running the tariffs.
Yeah. Then that was our sunshine to around the middle of the year. And then in August we thought it would turn to twilight. Well, it also looked like the stock market, the New York stock market, wanted to be positive into September, and that was fine with us because important stock market highs in New York in the September period, and that would be 1929 and also the great bubble that concluded in 1873. So having a rise there. Now, the other thing that got interesting on keeping things positive into September, Chris, was that the price of crude oil, as we noted in early September, seems to have gone into an old seasonal pattern where you could have a high late September, early October. I think the high was October the 3rd, and then go down. So this was set for a probable major decline once crude oil gave up, and it did. Now, then just to strictly look at the stock market, you had a high on the New York Stock Exchange advanced decline line. I think it was August 23rd, and it could lead the high, and I think the high on the S&P or something was September 22nd, something, say there. Through the summer, a number of equity guys suddenly getting on to the yield curve. And yes, the yield curve is important, but they were saying that it had to go inverted where you had, say, a week or so with short rates higher than long rates, which is a mark of speculation. There's terrific demand for short-term money when you're leveraged through the system. But we pointed out that in 1937-38, on that recovery, and the yield curve did not invert, it just rolled over. So our conclusion was the change in the credit, in the yield curve and in the credit spreads would be important. And yes, that came in. So then, Chris, the line we used in June was, would they go from sunshine to twilight in August, and then after that, the twilight zone has arrived. So then the next stage is, rather than fight it, our advice through the summer was to, for all accounts, to build liquidity. Just said, get liquidity. Again, we'll resort to history. And there have been five great bubbles since the first, the South Sea bubble in 1720. And number five was 1929. And of course, we had big bubbles with the dot-com in 2000, and then there was a pretty good, that was 2007 was a pretty good bubble. But you know, Chris, there were a few things missing there where one could call it a classic bubble. So we've been calling this one a classic bubble, similar to those great historical ones. All of those great bubbles, as they occurred in the first one in London and Paris, the London South Sea bubble peaked in June, dithered around the summer, crashed in the fall. Then everyone in Europe, as they occurred in Europe or London, peaked in the May-June window and crashed in the fall. Now, when New York became a big enough market to be important, which was with the 1873 bubble, it set its speculative high in September, and then again in 1929.
It must have its roots, at least initially, with the planting and harvesting cycles.
Chris, the demand for cash money early in the season for agriculture, and then the farmers get cash in the autumns. But
bring the holiday season into play.
The earliest documented fall crash, mortgages in the northern cities in Italy, and it's very well by the name of Cipolla. And they had their many mortgages, and then they decided that the local regulations were that they couldn't be traded. So then they decided that they could be traded because there was lots of pressures, and then it crashed. And the worst of those panics were in the fall. So that's as early as you can get on a fall crash.
You know, there's been so much said about the negative side, if you will, of finance. And just like so many things in the world, both can be true simultaneously. You can have a necessary evil. Wouldn't you say, though, that at least in the Western world, for the most part, we have used finance to push our economic production curve, if you will, and economic possibility frontier so forward beyond where we were just 50 to 100 years ago that it has been primarily, not always, but primarily a means to a much better socioeconomic ends. What I'm really driving at here is the invisible hand. I'm talking about the market clearing mechanism. I'm also interested in the supply-demand phenomenon that is at the heart of micro and macroeconomics, the key efficiencies that force industries to be more productive, and by being more productive, create greater value, greater economic wealth, and economic profits above normal profits to the benefit of society overall.
I've thought about the great booms quite a bit. What they do is accelerate innovation. You could also have, like Mensch or somebody did, an index of innovations dating back to 1790s or something like that. But at any rate, a long period of very tedious and trying price inflation with consumers' prices going up, interest rates going up, bond prices going down, so the financial side is very well beat up, then that reaches a peak, like in 1920. And then that period where real interest rates start to go up. And then you saw in Japan decades ago, it was, I can't remember the Japanese for it, but it was the very quick
Yeah, kites on.
In the 1920s, the reason for increasing profitability in business was you kept your shelves as bare as you dare.
Just in time.
There's nothing new in the marketplaces. And what we have is a pattern. I'm interested in pattern recognition. And to ask questions about why, you might just as well say, well, I don't like the Earth rotating at 365 days to the year. Why isn't it 370? So let me continue with pattern recognition and what happens in a contraction. This is where, again, we look at where on the great bubbles, the tendency in London was a peak in June. And then when New York became big enough, New York had its peak in September. But all five of the great bubbles suffered liquidity problems in the fall with forced liquidation, such that the last part of September and October were disasters. And then you would get a relief bounce, which it looks like the market could do now. And then you have a final washout in November that sort of clears the market of the last of the unsupportable positions. And then you have some stability. Now, one of the really biggest of those bubbles culminated in 1825, and it didn't clear in London until, well, Christmas and into New Year's, where the liquidity problem finally washed out.
That's because Great Britain had defeated Napoleon. That would have ushered in a decade or two of economic prosperity. And then you also had in the United States, with the help of France, had actually kicked the Redcoats out of Louisiana, which, of course, ended the War of 1812.
Well, one of the things that really helped speculation on that one, Chris, was that in the panic of 1797 in London, when the fear was that Napoleon was going to invade, also there were some tax measures changed, and Britain went off of gold. And then you then had a fabulous expansion of credit because the central bank was had no restrictions. And so then they went back on gold in 1820. But the market had learned to play with credit, and then you had the bubble of 1825, and some of the biggest stocks were mining stocks, Mexican, for example. In a month's time, they sort of went, underwritten at 10 pounds, traded at 50 pounds, and soared to 150. So you had action. Well, hey, the bubble we were in last year was a bubble in miners. That was Bitcoin miners. So anyways, you had a fabulous bubble, and it crashed, and then the typical pattern is for a long contraction. The abuse of the credit markets was so pervasive, so widespread, and so ruinous that it took a couple of decades to finally wash out all of the credit excesses. So I think this is highly probable. You have a fabulous exposure, a fabulous confidence that every speculator in any game whatsoever can be levered to a great prosperity. And then you've also got the concept that central banking intervention is successful. Now, some of these bubbles did occur when the senior central bank was on a gold standard. And they were lesser bubbles, but nonetheless, they crashed and you were followed by a contraction. So the conclusions from this, Chris, is that you go through a longish 15 years or so, 20 years or so, of rising commodity prices and rising inflation pressures and that. So then people in the markets hoard tangible assets, commodities, all this sort of stuff. Well, then this goes on as like in 1920, when that change in the commodity index on the way up was incredible. And then on the way down, it was a horrendous crash. And, for example, on the CPI inflation in 1920, it got up to 22%, where the policy world went crazy in 1980 when the inflation rate got up to 15%. So then that then sets up an era of inflation in financial assets, stocks and bonds. And in it was 1982 when I really began to take our research, which I'd been selling to big mining people, and then took it to financial institutions. And on a slide presentation, one of the key conclusions was that no matter how much the Fed prints, stocks will outperform commodities. Now, in 1982, that was quite a regular.
Let's just say a two-decade grueling U.S. equities market.
Yep. So anyways, we're now in, then you go in historically, where then eventually the public comes into the market, and it got in, which they did till 1929. And then when that speculation in paper fails, and you get the crash, and then you get the contraction, whereby then people decide they're going to hoard cash. And you recall the New Deal in the 1930s under Roosevelt actually was introduced by Hoover.
But you did bring up the 1929 speculative bubble, the crash and contraction. And one thing that's been overlooked up until recently by most analysts, the impact of the Smoot-Hawley trade tariffs, in retrospect, a key component to the froth that led up to the peak. And then, of course, perhaps the severity of the economic fallout that we felt not only in the United States, but throughout the Western world. Give us an idea of whether or not you think that the front running by executives to stockpile as much of their key strategic resources as possible ahead of these tariffs. Now that that passed, will we see a similar hangover in U.S. financial markets as we did in 29-30?
Well, I can't speak to any corporations hoarding things, because you're going into a period where everybody hoards cash. But the pattern has been that following great bubbles and the contraction is that each country suffers high unemployment and hardship, and the local politician has to do something about it. So now the tariffs that have been war that's been discussed with Trump is that he was attempting to reduce unfavorable tariffs against the United States, which had existed for some time. But the real tariff war comes with the recession that follows a great bubble. You mentioned Smoot-Hawley, but following the great 1825 bubble, the U.S. came out with a set of tariffs that at the time were called the tariff of abomination. For example, when I mentioned the 1921 crash in commodities, what did the Federal Reserve during the do the 1920s? They were easy, deliberately easy, because they were afraid basic wholesale prices were going to fall. So they were easy, trying to prevent prices falling. And they didn't understand financial manias, of which they then inadvertently fueled. And now, for the last decade, what has the Fed and policy wonks been concerned about? Well, they had to get inflation up to 2% or something awful would happen. So you were into a period where commodities weren't going anywhere, and the Fed got concerned about it and were easy trying to get inflation up, not understanding the nature of a big stock bubble. The exact same thing happened as in the 1920s. The only conspiracy I was able to find out was in the 1873 bubble, when a brilliant financier, a guy by the name of Jay Cook, got organized and was outstanding at placing U.S. debt during the Civil War. But he was an upstart and, of course, pushed it too far. And Morgan was not pleased. So in the August of 1873, Morgan might have let it known that he wasn't going to help out Jay Cook, who was overextended, got stuck with railroad bonds, and it crashed.
That sparks the thought, the Fisk Gold operations in tandem with the former general Ulysses S. Grant, now in the White House at that period, and their gold market scheme.
The Treasury Secretary couldn't hold back on selling gold, and Grant told him to sell it, but he was able to get word to Fisk ahead of time. So there's where you ended up with buying, ostensibly, and Fisk, the other side, selling out the whole position.
I'm sure you recall Fisk and Gould's operations on the Erie Railroad against Vanderbilt, the robber baron battles.
What we should be looking for is opportunity in here, and one of them would be the bottoming of this, let's call it forced liquidation. And, Chris, you know, it's really fascinating that through the summer, people were highly confident of the Fed's ability to keep everything going. And then when you get into a price hit in the magnitude of what we have seen so far, what happens is the power shifts over to the margin clerks. And the margin clerk's job description is vastly different to that of a central banker. The central banker's job description has been corrupted to keep the speculation going, i.e., in so many words, to get the accounts offside. And of course, we know the job description of a margin clerk is to get the accounts onside. And in every liquidity crisis, the margin clerk has had more power than the central bank. It's a fascinating world. In 1929, Harrison was chair of the New York Fed, which, like now, is a giant compared to the other Fed chapters. And he exceeded his lending authority by a factor of 6 times in buying bonds out of the market.
Don't discount the New York Fed. I don't know if you know this or not. Very few people are aware that the New York Fed is the only one of the 12 member banks that is always accounted for in the Federal Open Market Committee. In other words, they have a permanent seat. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York is arguably, always has been and will be, due to the terminology written in to the Federal Reserve Act.
I can tell you another fascinating anecdote about a top of a bubble in 1873 when you had strains appearing in the credit markets and experienced traders and investors could recognize those. But, of course, the media were on the bubble, and the Herald, published in New York, editorialized that, yes, something could go wrong, but the U.S., saying we, like America, had the Treasury system, and it did not have a central bank constrained by gold. And therefore, the Treasury system could discount unlimited amounts. So it could flood the money market at the first sign of trouble. Now, in England, you also had then the head of the editor at The Economist, Walter Bagehot. And he was highly regarded then, and still highly regarded, despite he published his major book called Lombard Street in 1873, and in it he put down the remedy to prevent contractions, which was to stand in there and the central bank would provide all kinds of liquidity. And that was well known in 1873. So both in the London market, which is the senior market, and New York, which was the junior market, they had the recipe to prevent contraction. And then the contraction came in, and it was very severe in England, which then was the focus point of the world economy. And a senior economist by 1884, now there was a recession and then some relief and then another recession, but in 1884 they looked at its continuation and of weak business and called it the Great Depression. And the Great Depression went to the final business cycle low in 1896 and then began to recover. But in that I had done all the research decades ago, you knew that senior economists in England, as late as 1939, were still analyzing the Great Depression, how it could have been prevented, how it could have been ameliorated, etc., meaning the Great Depression of 1873 to 1896. And then by about 1940, we've got another Great Depression. So, you know, senior economists and interacting with financial markets is a never-ending source of irony, and I love it. But, you know, there's very few places that would write this up about the futility of it all, Chris. And they policymakers, the world now considers that they shape events. They respond to events. And quite shortly here, if this liquidity problem continues, which I think it will, interest rates are going to start going down. The T-bill rate will start going down. The Fed will follow in cutting its administered rate, the zero again.
I really tend to side now with, of course, the Austrian, but also the monetarist view. Milton Friedman really was so many decades ahead of his time. I think he's one of the few who really earned his Nobel Prize. And you're right. I think it should be the mandate of the Federal Reserve, of the central banks, assuming we're going to play ball, and this is the system we have, and we both agree it's a flawed system. I do agree the Fed should not try to either forecast or predict. It really should react to excesses in the market. You might say the monetary tool is a much more responsive tool than the traditional Keynesian fiscal policy. It tends to be slow. Very rarely do the funds wind up in the intended sources when you use fiscal policy, whereas the monetary method, you have to admit, only because the institutions, the financial institutions, played ball and they held on to the massive reserves, $4 trillion that the Fed actually piled into our money center banking balance sheets. They didn't lend those funds. And we haven't seen yet this tidal wave of inflation precisely because they held on to those funds. And now we're seeing the unwinding of the entire process that's taking place over the next 10 years. Why don't you leave people an overview of what you see ahead for 2019? Will that be the year where the precious metals finally do catch a safe haven, risk on scenario? The 35-year bull market in bonds evaporates and U.S. equities lose some favor, and we see the commodities continue higher.
To gain, we're going to rely on history, Chris. In a great financial bubble, you take the price of gold and deflate it by the CPI in the senior currency, and the pattern since 1720 is that the real price of gold goes down in a bubble and gold stocks underperform. And the huge peak in the precious metal speculation in 2011, we had that one nailed right down. And because the silver-gold ratio got on the RSI got up to 92, and the only time it had been there before was in January of 1980. So here we go, and I'll explain how gold works in a deflationary environment. And every post-bubble contraction, as I say, in the bubble, the real price of gold has come down. It has come down and is trying to base for the last year. Now, the pattern has been that for the first few years of the contraction, the real price of gold goes up. It improves profit margins for the gold industry, and it starts to make money. And then eventually you will have that the action will trail down into the juniors, and you will have a great speculative market. in the past, these have lasted for 20 years, where the real price of gold has gone up. And, for example, in 1929 crash, Homestake, the premier producer, the stock fell down to 8 1/8 or something like that. But all through 1930-31, you could have bought the stock at $9 in that average. And then, and it wasn't until early 1933 when Roosevelt raised the price of gold. So we're looking at $20.67 an ounce price for gold. And in the 1929, Homestake lost money because their costs were up. In 1930, 31, and 32, they made money. Their earnings were up something like 130% to the end of 32. And their stock was up by about that much as well when all of the industrial stocks were in the tank. So there was no change in the nominal price of gold, but the real price went up. And this is where you have your best periods for gold mining have been in the post-bubble deflationary contractions. Now, we also, Chris, I did the deflated price of copper. I was able to get it back to 1830.
Let's pop forward, though, to the post-bubble contraction of 2001.
Chris, there's going to be no inflation in commodities. The price of gold will outperform all commodities so that the gold miners make a lot of money. And it's one of the only industry that you can analyze ahead of time that makes money in the post-bubble deflation. And this is what's going to happen. So this is where we're looking now to re-enter the gold market somewhere over the next 5 or 6 weeks on downward pressure. And mainly because for the long term, the gold mining side becomes extremely profitable, whether the U.S. is on a gold, or the, I should say, whether the senior currency is on a gold standard or not. There's a probability that the U.S. could go back on a gold, sound money.
See, I feel like I'm coming to the same, or let's say a similar parallel, from a completely different direction. I'm watching the European Central Bank ministers, Bank of Japan, the BOJ, the BOE, central banks. I'm listening to their rhetoric. And what I'm hearing is a chorus of surprisingly hawkish, you know, the U.S. dollar, America, the Fed, our policymakers, I think, have kind of had it made, you might say, for the past couple of 2 or 3 or even more years. I mean, they've had the luxury of allowing rates to drift higher, the luxury of increasing the benchmark overnight lending rate, while the rest of their colleagues and comrades around the world, for the most part, have kept their hand off of the rudder. But what it looks as though to me now is that the Fed is running out of bullets. They don't have too many more rate hikes, maybe 3 or 4 tops next year, and then that rate hike cycle will wrap up. This relative advantage that the U.S. dollar has had over in the Forex market, over the pound, the British pound, over the euro, over the yen, and over the yuan, will be coming to an end, and thus the U.S. dollar, more than likely, it will drift lower and continue perhaps to retest those lows that we saw several years ago. It should be in a sideways to downward trend as we see the quantitative easing operations wrap up around the globe now, as those central bankers play catch up with the United States. Your thoughts there?
The only reason why these central bankers have been able to expand their portion of the credit is because you've had speculators in financial items. And then when they quit, they seem to be quitting day by day here, then even the most aggressive central banker cannot get its portion of credit out the window. Why do they call it a credit contraction?
I would argue that at least 50% of that argument is due to the fact that we had record low interest rates. So our corporations could issue debt at a record clip with virtually no punishment. They could just sell debt almost for free, as much debt as they wanted. What did they do with that? Well, they filled their balance sheets with their own shares. So they've been buying back and issuing, buying back their equity and filling their balance sheets. Those buybacks are a key component here. So it's not just speculators. Those days are over because rates are going up.
It's, as you're pointing out, a great expansion of debt. It's done in a time of rapture and enthusiasm and no risk and all of that stuff. And all you need is a majority of that debt to be due and payable in senior currency units. The senior currency is the U.S. dollar. So once the bubble is over, it looks like it's over, the tide changes and corporate treasurers get interested in paying down debt. I've called it the great debt revulsion. But so then they have to sell something in order to, whether they are in Turkey or Egypt or Bolivia, they have to sell something in order to get their hands on a dollar to meet their obligations in New York. So the debt bubble is becomes the biggest short on the senior currency in history, which we have. So my net conclusion on it, and I've used the phrase for more than a few years, is that the pattern for the senior currency in a post-bubble contraction is that it is chronically strong against most commodities and most other currencies for most of the time. And the bottom in U.S. dollar, the DX, it's got slammed in February down to 88, where it became very oversold. And then our work, we needed to have at least a couple of months of building a base. And then it needed to break above the 20-week exponential moving average, which it did at 90.5 on April the 23rd, and it is in a pretty good uptrend. And I think that breaking a right out about, like into the 97 level, the move measures to 103, and if we get into a very severe contraction, it'll go to 120. And this is not so much my imagination, Chris, it's that following every great bubble, the senior currency becomes chronically strong. And you can follow that all the way back to the writings of Thomas Gresham in 1550s, when he was the British agent in the money market in Antwerp. Antwerp. And in his letters to Burleigh, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, he explains the problem in bad times of trying to service debt from a weak currency, then sterling, into the guilder, which was then the senior currency and strong. So this is a pretty old evidence trail that in the bad times, the senior currency goes up.
Remember Gresham's law, of course, bad money drives out good. We can draw parallels with your first thought and this thought, and that is that maybe the money that everybody is searching for is the bad money, that the senior currency is actually the riskier place relative to precious metals, but maybe that's a discussion for another day. Why don't you give people your feel, your gut instinct, and what the charts and your analysis are suggesting for U.S. equities, global equities, as well as corporate debt, and perhaps the precious metals, crude oil, and whatnot, the best you can over the next 6 months?
This liquidity problem will probably clear in November, December. Crude oil down until January, dismal lows. Then some rebounds into the first part of the year, and then, say, after March, April, then the next leg of the bear market would come in. It will be an extensive and a serious bear market. On the credit market side, it probably could get bad enough such that the the Federal Reserve loses its mandate to be reckless, and it could be curbed quite a bit. I think Trump is very savvy on this. When he first started to knock the Fed, I thought, shouldn't be saying anything about the Fed. But then in the summer when he kept hitting it, and I thought, oh, yeah, and if we go into a contraction in the fall, he's laid the blame on the Fed, which is brilliant for raising interest rates. So folks should be prepared for a post-bubble contraction. As you know, Chris, we've got a whole lot of history on those, and you can get in touch with us. Bob Hoy, just do bobhoy.com, bobhoy.com.
Bob Hoy, Institutional Advisor. We'll talk soon.
Good to talk. Bye-bye.